welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Lillian Vasquez in conversation with violinist and conductor André Rieu. André Rieu and his Johann Strauss Orchestra have a couple of stops in our region soon, in San Diego, March 18th at Pechanga Arena, and at the Honda Center in Anaheim, March 21st. More later in the program. First, though, an actor who you just have to have seen. Maybe it was on a rather heavy role spanning a few episodes of Grey's Anatomy, or maybe with his recurring roles on The West Wing, Scandal, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, NCIS, and more over the last almost 40 years. And he's part of a new series getting ready to kick off soon. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us today is actor and all-around decent human being, Michael O'Neill. We have all seen Michael in many roles on the big screen and television, but today Michael will give us a peek into the new series on NBC, Council of Dads. Thank you for joining us today, Michael.
Oh, listen, Emmanuel, thank you for having me with you. I'm looking forward to this.
I don't know. I think you've raised up the expectation on me so much that now I should just go somewhere and find a bag and hide in a closet.
There's a wonderful phrase in acting. Just let me be unencumbered by their good opinion of me.
Oh, I'm going to remember that one. At least for this interview.
You're on.
No, Michael, in your new series, Council of Dads, you play a character named Larry Mills. But before we speak more about this new show on NBC, will you tell us when you started acting and the first role that you played?
I started in the early 70s, sort of mid 74, 75, 76. I didn't know anything about acting, Emmanuel, and I knew that I wanted to get out of the South at that time. So I moved to California. I moved to Los Angeles, mostly to see if I could survive. And I got out there, and I was very, very fortunate to get tied in with a wonderful little Shakespearean troupe in Topanga Canyon. It's called Theatricum Botanicum, Theater in the Gardens. And it was started by a wonderful character actor named Will Gere. He played the grandfather on the Waltons. And Will had done just about every conceivable kind of theater, from Doc Bart's Riverboat Show to the silent films to talkies to Chautauqua tours, just everything. And I mean, you know, Steinbeck had hired him to do Of Mice and Men, and Faulkner had cast him several times. So he was kind of a walking encyclopedia. But Will invited me to join the company, and his daughter, Ellen Gere, really trained me. But my first role, I was playing Friar John in Romeo and Juliet. Friar John runs out and says, I couldn't get the letter to Romeo. There was a plague. And so I'm standing there looking up at Will, who's backlit by the sun with his great, you know, mane of white hair. And I, you know, got the lines out, and a couple of the seasoned actors ran over and went, wow, that was really good. I thought you were really anxious about having to deliver that message. And I just looked at them and I said, that wasn't acting.
Okay.
That was my first one. That was my very first one. Now, my first television role, which I think is probably what you're asking about, there was a short-lived series on NBC, interestingly enough, called The Shirley Jones Show.
Oh, wow.
And I played the romantic interest for Roseanne Arquette on that in an episode. And I got to work with Shirley and also John McIntyre, who was a very wonderful seasoned veteran character actor that I admired a great deal. So I think I've always had my eye on that, you know, role out in the far, far future. I admired them greatly. There was something about the gravitas of the guys that had survived for a long time that really appealed to me. So that was my aspiration.
Okay. Now, I don't want to blow you out of the water with your first acting role, but I found out something by looking around a little bit, that you actually played a leaf in first grade.
It was a non-speaking part.
Okay.
There was no language for the leaf.
Oh.
And that was my first and only role for some 18 years, I think. We probably saved the theater some bad mishap in that time.
Well, yeah. I'm sure the leaf got some great reviews.
I can remember putting on the costume in the boys' bathroom at Morning View Elementary School.
No, you were actually going to school for something else, but Will Gere actually did something in your life that helped change the direction of it. What did Will do? I mean, we all know him as that guy on the Waltons, Grandpa, But you knew him as a person that had some pretty frank and straightforward things to say to you that helped change your life. What did he do?
Well, the first thing that happened, I sort of jumped into the middle of the story, but I was an economics major at Auburn University. I had written an address for my national fraternity about what I thought the pros and cons of the fraternity system were, the fact that I had an opportunity to meet people that were wildly different than I was, and it broadened my experience greatly. They recorded that address. I delivered it in Muncie, Indiana, and Will heard it because the editor of the magazine was in California interviewing distinguished alumni from that fraternity. He was obviously a member 50 years earlier at a different city.
Okay.
But he said, "Do you know how to get in touch with this fellow?" And they said, "Yeah, he's at Auburn." He said, "Call him." You know, that wonderful gravelly voice he had. "Emmanuel, I get on the phone. You know, I have no idea who's on the other end." And he said, "Son, this is Will Gear, and I think you ought to try acting before the corporate structure snaps you up."
Wow.
I said, "Mr. Gear, I don't know anything about it." He said, "Well, I'll come to California. I'll work with you." I said, "Can I call you back?" He gave me his home number.
Wow.
And I went and talked to him. This part of the story, it's not what you ask after, but if you indulge me,
I went and talked to a man
who owned a lumber yard in Auburn. He was a bright, bright man, a Fulbright scholar, but one of the most no-nonsense men I'd ever known, really intimidating, actually. And I went to him to ask his counsel on it, thinking he would say, "Michael, don't fool around, get a job, start your family, you know." And he leaned back in his chair and he said, "Well, you know you have to go, don't you? And you could have knocked me over with a feather." And I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "Yeah, you probably won't make it, but you don't want to look back on your life and wonder what it would have been like if you had gone." You know, those two counsels in a row. And so 4 days later, I packed my car and moved to California.
Well, that's like striking oil for the Beverly Hillbillies there.
You know, it was.
Yeah.
And I honestly think I got dragged kicking and screaming into a better life.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this about Will. He was a botanist by education, and botanists like to throw seeds. And if I heard him say that, "I think you should try acting before the corporate structure snaps you up," once, I heard him say it 100 times.
Wow.
I thought he was talking to me. He just liked to stir things up. And so I took him at his word and drove across country. But I come to find out that I wasn't so special after all. But I was tenacious, so I just hung on.
That is really a great story because it kind of deflates some things about ourselves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You think,
Yeah.
This guy was thinking of only me. I was the only one in the universe, and here I am.
Yeah,
and he's on the phone telling someone else. Yeah, the very same thing.
Yeah, I'll never forget when I found that out. My head snapped when I heard him say it. I'm like,
right.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Okay, that is wonderful. Now, Michael, I have to admit, I have seen you play many acting roles in, just my goodness, all kinds of movies, whether it was Transformers, Grey's Anatomy, Extent with Halle Berry, Dallas Buyers Club, that was great with Matthew McConaughey, and you've done so much more. I'm curious, what was your most challenging role to play?
Well, I think the most challenging, honestly, Emmanuel, was Grey's. You know, the character on Grey's Anatomy, you know, I played a lot of characters to that point that were reliable. You know, I'd done The West Wing and I played Butterfield on that. And most of the characters that I played, when they stepped on screen, you knew things were going to settle down. You know, there was a problem solver, a reliable person. And Grey's flipped the script on that.
Okay.
And I became a man who was desperately broken, who had lost his wife and got lost in the shuffle and never emotionally could handle the loss of the one thing that tethered him to some sort of an emotional reality. And I don't know if you've ever seen the episodes, but the long and the short of it is that my character walked into Seattle Grace Hospital looking for surgeons and started a shooting spree that was devastating to them and devastating to me.
Right.
Honestly, that was a huge challenge. And the challenge inside of that for me was, it was a monstrous act, monstrous. So how do you bring some humanity? How do you reveal a man who's desperately damaged and in pain about what he's doing but can't stop himself? I hope we succeeded at that.
I think you did. I was around when Grey's Anatomy came out. Actually, I'm older than they are.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. Well, I only wanted to speak for myself, but I thank you for joining in.
Okay. There's an accomplishment in aging, I find.
Yeah, you know, and there's also strength in numbers. Thank you.
Yeah, we have them.
Yes, we do.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, it's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with violinist and conductor Andre Rieu in our region soon. First, though, back to Emmanuel Rogers speaking with actor Michael O'Neill. He's part of Council of Dads, kicking off on NBC quite soon. With O'Neill's near 40-year acting history, they did talk about other projects as well, some past, some quite current.
Currently, I'm on Amazon Prime in Jack Ryan, the second season of Jack Ryan.
Oh, yes.
I worked with John Krasinski on that last year, and so that is imminently available. I have the film Clemency that I did last year that is just moving out of theaters and probably into the stream.
Yes.
Alfred Woodard was, in my estimation, the singular brilliant performance that I witnessed. There are other brilliant performances, but I never saw anyone play something that was so devastating with such a thorough commitment as Alfie did. Mm-hmm. McConaughey had that. He had a remarkable freedom, Dallas Buyers Club. Now let's see what else is out there. A little film is coming out called A Stand in Paxton County, and I play a North Dakota rancher who got swindled out of his livestock. And my two favorite films that I adore, Seabiscuit, which I did in 2004-2005, and also Secondhand Lions with Bobby Duvall and Michael Caine, is a film that I have great fondness for, and Transformers that you mentioned. So hopefully there's enough out there they'll stumble upon me.
Well, I think stumble is probably saying it mildly. I think they'll be hit by you as they would be Optimus Prime if they were standing in the middle of the road when he was coming down the street.
He's hard to avoid.
He really is. And I want to encourage the audience because, you know, you mentioned a lot of places, but they can find you almost everywhere. And that is without exaggeration and in a lot of great productions. I really did enjoy Dallas Buyers Club. It surprised me how much I liked it. You play a great role in being someone that, good Lord, I don't want that guy looking for me. And Transformers, it goes without saying for me, people have heard me talk, I love these kinds of movies. So it was great to see you there. It's like, I know this guy. So it's great to actually be able to talk to this guy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Emmanuel. Any actor worth their salt will tell you that. I remember Alan Alda once saying when we asked him what advice he would give to an actor, and he said, above all else, be lucky.
All right.
And I have been, you know, to work with the people and the projects that I've worked on. I've had great good fortune with that, and some of them still hit my rib cage whenever I see it or someone mentions it. It still has a profound effect on me.
Yes.
The West Wing. You know, I mean, that was really instrumental to my career because it sort of put me in the television community in a way that I stayed. The character Ron Butterfield, the head of the Secret Service,
right,
President's Protection Detail. And people walk up to me all the time about that role. And I always say the Secret Service doesn't comment on procedure. They seem to like the quote, so I'll stay with it.
I like that. I'm going to change just a little bit here because you are also known for doing work to help people. For example, Teach for America, Reading to Elementary School Children, Habitat for Humanity, and Focus on Recovery in Birmingham are just some of the things I've found out about. What does this charitable work entail, and why are you doing them?
You know, I think it's important to give back. You know, usually we're so busy trying to pursue a career and get to the next job that it's easy to forget the community at large needs something. And I just realized for myself, because I was a terribly poor reader as a child, I was afraid of it, you know? So when the opportunity came to read to school children, I thought it was a nice match. Or to do Teach for America and go in and talk about how important mathematics is to filmmaking. That if my focus puller doesn't get the exact dimension that he wants in that depth of field, then the focus is off. And we're not going to see clearly what's happening. And to see those kids begin to make a connection about the practical application of what they're learning in different professions because they're like sponges, you know, they're so willing to take it in. You know, I'm old enough to have made some mistakes along the way, so I'm a huge believer in second chances and redemption. And, you know, my work in the recovery field with focus on recovery, and particularly because the halfway house that I was most focused on dealt with moms.
Okay.
And that's important because that's generational.
Yes.
That affects children. And to see a mom have an opportunity to come back to a sober life and be a productive member of society and pay their bills and do their job and raise their children, you know, that's a stone on the water for me that you really can't know where it's going to roll out.
Right.
And I've been involved with the drug courts a bit, what we call the diversion courts, which is, I think, is important. We can either throw people in prison, and I'm not sure that that's a skill set we want them to learn.
Right.
Or we can try to shift them to the really hard work of rehabilitation.
Yeah, learning how to live.
Yes, you know, rehab, and then getting an education, and then getting a job, and finding their way back to actually doing something, and to be free of the addiction so that they're free to be productive in life. So all those things have a meaning for me, I guess, Emmanuel. And I hope I can do more. You know, I hope this is just the beginning of this. And I'm getting up there.
Yes.
So I don't swing a hammer as well as I used to, but I can still hit a nail when I'm after it, you know, one out of three times. So Habitat will let me come, and we'll keep going.
Okay, now this is probably not just a great question at all, but I'm going to ask it because Jimmy Carter also does this. Have you run across him?
You know, it's one of the people that I've wanted in my adult life to meet, and I've not. I never have, and I feel like I should make a trip to Plains, Georgia, just to pay homage because, you know, every once in a while we get a statesman.
Yes.
And that's what he's been. You know, in the charity world, he's been a statesman. In the political world, in the international world, he's been a statesman. And I think it emanates from a genuine goodness in that man. He's the least pretentious person who's been the leader of the free world I've ever seen. So I think it's safe to say he's a hero of mine.
Yeah.
I hope I get that chance.
Yeah, I think he's a hero to a great many people. And even if he wasn't a president at one time, his example of continuing to go out there and help people at his age and not thinking about that is heroic to me. Okay, so now that we've lifted him up all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's speak just briefly about you have a family. You have a wife and three daughters. Now, you do a lot of work. You're out there doing a lot of things. How does your family feel about that? And really, are they just so glad just to have you around when you're there?
Well, it's interesting you say that because I'm home for the first time in 5 months. And, you know, it's funny because they get accustomed to doing it their way. They run their lives and they run the household. And then I come back and I'm like, hey, don't leave that there. And they look at me like, excuse me, who are you again?
I know that guy. Yeah.
Okay. It's very, I was like, wait a second, I live here. And but they've been incredibly supportive. And moreover, I think I became a better actor when I had my children. It took some of the onus off, you know, to be able to come home. And honestly, they'd meet me at the front door and they didn't care whether I'd gotten the job or not, if the audition had gone well or if I had done what I was trying to execute.
Right.
Dad was home.
Yes.
You know, and they were loving and funny and mischievous. And they continue to be. My oldest just graduated from college, so she's about to go out into the world. And then I have twin girls that are still in college. And they're just a great source of joy to me. I mean, somebody asked me after the first year what I was most surprised at having children. And I said, honestly, I didn't know my heart could get this big. And,
right.
And that's continued. You know, that's continued. And they also have a way of keeping me in my place. You know what I mean? They don't let this actor thing get out ahead of itself. So I try to stay in the middle of the boat and not get out on the prow. And they're very good at handing me an oar and going, it's your turn to row, buddy. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Yeah, it's nothing like having kids that make you know that, wow, my feet are not only on the ground, but sometimes so is my face.
Well said.
Thank you. Now, we get to some of the meat and potatoes here. We're going to talk about this author that you brought up a little earlier, Bruce. Now, how do you pronounce his last name?
I say Feiler, but
I've seen Feiler.
I've heard several. And I've heard that pronunciation as well. Yeah. And I'm sure Bruce will correct me when he hears it.
Yes.
So, or correct me. But, for some reason, I've always said Feiler. There's just something in the phonic of when I look at it. But it could be Feiler. It could well be.
Okay, so now your show is based on a book that he wrote. where Bruce was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer and the possibility of not surviving was very real. Mm-hmm. Will you give us what his reaction was to this news?
Well, the other complication was, and I did speak of this a little bit ago, was that he just had twin girls.
Right.
So his life had changed dramatically. His responsibilities, you know, the landscape of it, you know, I'm sure his heart got a lot bigger. And so to go from that great joy to the great question of will I survive to see them raised?
Yes.
Will I survive to see them grow up? You know, anyone who's ever been in that circumstance knows what that question does to you. And Bruce, you know, was a man of action. So as he addressed that cancer, and you're right, in those days, the numbers weren't great on that diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, he met it headlong. He went into very, very difficult treatment. But as he finished that first year, which is sort of decisive, he called together his best friends, six of his best friends, and he said, if I don't make it, please mentor my children. And as a father who's looking at the possibility of his absence, to take the action to bring somebody in to make sure that they're going to be okay,
yes.
It's a powerfully dramatic story, and that's the essential core of our story. Bruce brought in six. We have three. We condensed it to one of the guys that grew up with him, was a boyhood friend, his oncologist who had treated him, had been his wife's best friend in medical school in our story, and then my character, Larry, who in our story, Scott, who plays the father, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay.
And sponsored me and knew a great deal about me. We had a great respect for one another. And he knew that I lost my first family to alcoholism.
Oh, wow.
And
oh, wow.
And I think was actually, although he asked me to help his family, knew that he was giving me a chance at a second family to make repair for what I had lost. So it's a wonderfully complicated and loving and challenging dynamic, because Larry doesn't know if he has the skill set to do it, but he knows he's got the intention to honor his friend's wish.
Well, yeah, I saw the clip, and it was wonderful to see you walk up to the door, hand the kid some food, tell him, hey, put it in the oven for this long,
yeah.
And then walk away. And you're like, wait, who are
yeah.
you? And that's just great. But what's more striking is when you just talked about Bruce having six friends, because that is a rich man who has mm-hmm. six friends that he can trust with his children when he's gone, that they won't do something to scar them. They'll just be human and teach them. That is
yeah.
a rich man. And to have three, I think that would be rich also.
I think so, too. You know, it's funny. I just gave the commencement address at my oldest daughter's graduation at Auburn. And the thing that I talked about was, and I'd heard it, there was a rector in a church. I was daydreaming in church one day and until he said, you know, we all want our children to have better lives than we have.
Yes.
And we usually think about that in terms of their status in life or their education or their financial well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the finest thing that we can leave for our children is the example of our friendships.
Yes.
And I believe that's true. And for Bruce to have had the wisdom to make sure that that's what his legacy was going to be, not just that they would be hands-on and helping make sure that those children were all right,
yes.
but the example of that friendship, to be able to call on someone like that in their hour of literally greatest need and what that means. So it works on a lot of levels.
It really does. It really does. Because each person that the character who has the cancer, each person that he asks has a different skill set. Mm-hmm. Now, there are those who are camping dad and, you know, advice yeah. dad. Which one are you?
Well, I am that dad that would bring the casserole,
okay.
you know, and say exactly what to do with it and then get out of there.
That, okay.
you know, his skill set is basically to try to do the next right thing.
Okay.
Sometimes with elbows attached, but usually as succinctly and as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Right.
I think that's Larry. You know, he knows the family less than anyone. He's genuinely the outsider, so they have to get used to him a bit, and he them. So in that regard, I think I'm the guy that just shows up and tries to do the next right thing in taking care of what their needs are
yes.
and then get out of the way.
That's actor Michael O'Neill, part of the cast of Council of Dads, in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. Council of Dads is set to premiere on NBC March 24th. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. Later in the program, it's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with violinist and conductor Andre Rieu in our region soon.
Council of Dads is a wonderful example of the power of friends and family, but it's also a wonderful example of it takes a village. Now, who are the people that you work with on the show? Because you have some wonderful co-stars, Sarah Wayne Callies, Tom Everett Scott, Clive Standing, and others. So how is it for you working with these wonderful people?
You know, I think the thing that surprised me the greatest about when we came together to do the pilot last March, it's the quickest I've seen a genuine affection form inside of a company. We're all worried about our creative process. We're all trying to make contribution to it. We're all trying to find our footing and the nerves of all that. And this company came together very, very quickly. I think a lot of it had to do with the source material. I think a lot of it had to do with Sarah Wayne Callies. She is our lead in this, and she's as wonderful a person as she is an actress.
Wow.
So that cast a very long shadow of how we would relate to one another. And then J. August Richard and Clive Standen, they're both accomplished actors, but really fine people.
Yes.
You know, and Clive has a bunch of children of his own. J. is, you know, deeply involved in nieces and nephews, so he knows something about the arc of that. And then Michelle Weaver and Stephen Silver, the two young adults that add an entirely other dimension to this cast, they were a joy to work with. They were as generous as any actors I've ever been around. And is supportive and is kind, and it's funny. The material's not always easy, so it's important to catch your breath and have a good laugh. And our writers have done that in the show. They've been very, very smart about that.
Right.
There are moments that you're going to want to hug your family, and there are moments that you're just going to look at one another and laugh because you'll recognize, you know, your very own dynamic in a family.
Yes.
And I just feel very, very fortunate. I've said this before, Emmanuel. I've been waiting on this role for about 25 years.
Wow.
And what I didn't know was that I'd been waiting on this cast for 25 years as well.
Ah.
So, good people.
Yeah. And some of them actually had to get out of elementary school for us to make it to a point where they could act at this time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
That is really
great. You know, and it's funny you mention that because we also have this young cast, Blue Chapman and Taya Tron and MJ. I mean, they add a whole dimension to this thing. You know, children have an energy, and it's a kaleidoscope. That's all I can say. It's just a kaleidoscope.
It really is.
And it's fun to turn it and fun to watch it.
Yeah, it actually looks a lot like America, the idea that, you know, we've talked about for so many years in this country of all the people that, you know, we're not alike, but we live together.
Yeah, and I love that about it. I personally, Emmanuel, I grew up in a segregated South as a child.
Yes.
So to see the evolution and the progress and the communities begin to form, and it was really, really, really important to me. And so when I look at the composition of this cast and see people that I recognize in roles that I recognize, it lifts me up, as it were. I don't hold to the fact that we're all wildly different
yes.
than one another. I think there are a great many more similarities among people than there are differences, whatever your background, you know. We all love our children the same way.
Yes.
We all want a better life for them, and we're all willing to work hard to provide it. So I think we've captured some of that, and hopefully we're holding up the mirror to society.
Well, you definitely have the fact that, you know, everybody that wears pants has two legs. So that works.
Yeah.
It really works.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't been to the circus lately, so I don't know what else might be out there right now.
There's going to be something.
There
we
really
can count
will.
On that.
Yeah. And as a human being, I'll be surprised, probably laugh, cry, and say, I don't ever want to see that again. But I learned yes. something today. Now,
yeah, I recognized something today.
Yes. No, I don't want you giving away anything on the show because in real life, our person Bruce here, Mr. Feeler, he survived.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to know, the young people that are working in the show with you, are we going to see them as the series evolve? Are we going to see them grow up with the help of our Council of Dads?
I believe so. Okay. Yes. The short answer is yes.
Okay.
And, you know, Tom Everett Scott plays Bruce's character, and Tom is, he's not just one of the most accomplished people I've been around, but also a great heart beats in that chest. You can't look at him and not care about him.
Right.
So he carries the heartbeat of this for us, he and Sarah, really. But those children, it's fascinating that you asked that, because they do begin to grow up.
Yes.
And, you know, MJ Anthony, who's an adolescent, he's got all the stuff that adolescent kids have.
Yes.
You know, that wonderful, you know, you're neither child nor adult. And so you're in that nether world that's not comfortable. And I don't know the kid, you know, certainly I watch my daughters go through it. And Talia Tron, it's wonderful because she has this quality of being this wizened older woman at 14. And young Blue Chapman, who I think is a star, you know, at 7. And Michelle Weaver plays the oldest of those children. They all bring a different shade to it. They all bring a different perspective to it. But we watch them grow.
Yes.
You know? We watch them as a family move forward. And I love that aspect in our writing.
Yes, and I laugh and joke about a lot of these things, and that's one of the ways I deal with life. But I was thinking, you know, on the show, we might, if this guy does not pass away from his disease, we might have to take and put a pillow over his head and do something about that. Because.
Well, there are a lot of ways to be a dad.
Yeah.
And a lot of ways to be a counsel. So
yes.
We're going to explore a bunch of them.
Okay. Now, I really wanted to ask you before our conversation ended, because you have done so many things, and you did mention that this is one of the roles that you've been waiting for. But is there a role in your many years of acting that you would really love to just take on? And if so, what would that role be?
You know, one that I haven't played, you mean? One
yes.
that I would like to play.
Yes, one that you've thought about, dreamed about. That's my, I just really would love to get in and do Shakespeare or something else.
It's funny, Emmanuel, at some point in my life, I'd like to do Mark Twain. Hal Holbrook's a dear friend and one of the character actors that I most admire and respect. So that's, you know, something that I think of from time to time.
Yes.
In terms of a filmic role, I've always had this in my head. I wanted to play a veterinarian that took care of a small town somewhere. You know, he took care of the livestock and he took care of the people. And so that dynamic has always fascinated me. And you know, I suppose I'd need somebody to write it and produce it and somebody to let us live it out. But I've always kind of been fascinated by that. And I don't even know where all that story goes. But, you know, small towns are wonderfully eccentric.
Yes.
And, you know, there's an issue with rural health care now, a legitimate issue. A lot of people are having a lot of difficulty and have to travel a very, very long way to find medical care. And I thought if there were a story about a guy who, it's not his first choice, but he's willing to take it on. My dad was a medic. He was a Navy corpsman in World War II in the Pacific Theater.
All right.
And I think this is what it's sourced from, to be honest with you, Emmanuel, because I saw my dad do stuff. You know, if there were an emergency, he was the guy you would want there first.
Yes.
And he wasn't a doctor, but he saved lives. And, you know, I remember a kid in our neighborhood that got run over by a car. And my dad was underneath that car with that child so fast that I remember coming out of my house and just seeing the soles of his shoes. Afraid he'd been hit. He was under there treating. He was doing triage. And that child ended up being fine, you know.
Wow.
But it just, there's something about that still resonates for me. So I want to play that role.
That sounds great. I mean, I was actually seeing it as you were speaking. Yeah, that sounds great. But I would also love to see that Mark Twain character done by you. I think you would do it well. I really do.
Well, I hope so. He solved a lot of problems for me, Mark Twain did, or he answered a lot of questions for me about a lot of things, civil rights, exploration, travel. He was a great lighter of torches as far as I was concerned, and his wit appeals to me a great deal. I think I understand something about the rhythm of it, so
right.
I'm not done. We'll see if I can get a bite of that apple.
I hope you do. You know, you've given us much more time than we could ask for or have imagined here, so I really do want to thank you for that. And from what I've seen, you guys have already, in part, broken a leg, as they say. So I want to just thank you for taking time out from your very busy schedule to come and share with us things about you, your new show, Council of Dads. Thank you again, Michael, and Godspeed with the show.
Thank you, Emmanuel. And I really appreciate you, you know, indulging me and letting me go on about stuff. Mark Twain had a great line. He said, it's a terrible death to be talked to death. So I hope I didn't do that, but I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed today. I love the questions that you ask, but just the exchange, you know, just the quality of the exchange just didn't feel like an interview to me. It just felt more like you're very good at what you do. You make it a lot easier on me, I can tell you that.
I've seen some of the interviews on YouTube, and I thought, wow, he looks like he would like to get this over with.
That one was painful.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to do that to people. If I haven't done it at all, I don't know. But David Fleming, the host of the show here, has encouraged me a great deal with, let's just have a conversation.
Mm.
And so there are people that we know. If you and I were sitting on a train and people in front and behind and on the side of us, their conversations would stop and they would be listening. And that's what we're looking for. People wanting to listen. And they'll want to listen to this.
Well, I enjoyed it. I really appreciate it.
You got it. This was a great deal of fun for me also. And I am so glad that you enjoy talking about what you do. That makes a great difference.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of my daughters, Molly, said to me, she said, Dad, I want you to write a book. I said, why? She said, Dad, you've lived an interesting life. I'd like to know more about it. So it never occurred to me that that was so. Particularly as actors, we're so busy just trying to find our way to the next job that it's sort of hard to turn around and look back.
Right.
But I suppose age does that to you, you know, a bit.
Yes.
And Will said something to me, which I didn't understand at the time. We were in the theater rehearsing something, and he stopped. He walked up to me and said, you know, I see you. You're anxious to make your mark. But I'm going to tell you something, son. It's the road going, not the getting there, that you'll look back on and cherish. And now that I'm looking back a little bit, I see what he means. It is. It's the road going. It's been an interesting road.
That was actor Michael O'Neill in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. Once again, Council of Dads is set to premiere on NBC on March 24th at 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, following the This Is Us season finale, then moving to an 8 p.m. time slot. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Now, into the orchestral world with someone who's no stranger to KVCR, radio or TV, and a couple of performance opportunities in our region quite soon. Lillian Vasquez has more.
My guest is Maestro André Rieu. He has performed all over the world with his Johann Strauss Orchestra for over 32 years. He's coming back to Southern California.
Yes, it's fantastic to talk to you again, Lillian.
Thank you. Your father was a conductor. As you and your siblings were exposed to music at a very early age, what instruments did you play as a child?
My first instrument was the violin, but I tried the hobo and the trumpet and the piano. But, you know, my first teacher, the violin teacher, was an 18-year-old blonde girl, so that helped a lot. So I fell in love with her, and so it was the violin.
So I was going to ask you, why did you settle on the violin? It couldn't have just been for the good-looking 18-year-old. Why did you settle on the violin?
Because it was immediately very clear that that was my instrument, because When you have the violin under your chin and you play, you really feel the vibrations in your body, and that's what I wanted. You know, that the piano was too much of a distance from me, so the violin was really working with my body, and that, you know, I'm very jealous of singers. In fact, singers are the most privileged instrumentalists there are, because they have their instrument in their body.
Right.
And that's the most fantastic thing there is.
What type of violin do you play, and why that specific type of violin?
So, of course, when I was a student, I had my first violin. My father bought it for me. And now, after all these years, I'm a very lucky man, because I have the money to buy a Stradivarius.
Mm.
And everybody speaks about it, Stradivarius, because, you know, it's fantastic to every morning I open my case and there he is. It's really a miracle that after all these 400 years, this instrument is still there and complete as Stradivari built it. So, and then you put it under your chin and it is as if the violin knows what you are going to play because she helps you in all the ways. So it's really a privilege for me. And I tell you, Lillian, I bought it. It's mine, but I don't feel it's mine. I'm the caretaker for the people who are going to play after me.
Beautiful. Your concerts are filled with humor and laughter beyond music. For those that might not have ever been to one of your concerts, can you explain what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Not only my concerts, but when you would sit with me in the afternoon, then there is also a lot of laughter and humor because I think we need that in life. Life without humor and laughter, it's so dull. Also during my concerts, I try to be myself on stage, and because I'm always laughing and using humor, I do it also on stage. So, you know, you see a lot of classical musicians and they come on stage and then suddenly you know them backstage and they are making jokes and laughing, and then they come on stage and suddenly they are serious as if they are already dead. So I never understood that. So I try to be myself on stage.
Right. I think it, I was frightened, not frightened, but I stayed away from classical music until I met your music and interviewed you and got to know your music. You made classical music inviting for all.
Yeah, you know, Mozart, everybody knows the music of Mozart, and a lot of people know about Mozart's life. He was a lively guy, and he was really in the middle of life and enjoying life and making dirty jokes. And so I don't understand why we play Mozart with a face as if we are already dead. So I try. And in the time of Mozart, there was no difference between classical music and not classical music. Mm-hmm. You know, all the people in the street were whistling his tunes. And that's what I try to bring back, that all this beautiful music goes back to the street where it belongs.
When did you fall in love with the waltz, as you are the king of waltz?
That was very early, because my father loves to play encores in his concerts, and his favorite encores were Strauss waltzes. So I was there as a little boy, 5, 6, 7 years old, and no, even earlier. And then I saw all these people around me sitting very stiff and listening serious to Bach and Beethoven and Rachmaninoff. And then the encore came, and he played the Danube or whatever waltz by Strauss. And suddenly I saw that all the audience around me suddenly were smiling and humming the melody and moving their bodies in the rhythm of the three-quarter time. So that was the first time I thought, oh my God, this is also a way of making music. Mm. And I loved it.
In the concert Love in Maastricht, which is your hometown, where you perform in the town square and you have for the past several years, you waltz with a woman that you stated was 103. What does music provide, or what did it do to this woman?
I tell you, of course it was her, because sadly, I have to tell you, she passed away yesterday.
Oh.
At 105.
Oh.
She was my biggest fan here in Maastricht. She was a sister in a convent, and it goes back to almost 30 years ago that I was playing with my small salon orchestra, giving concerts, and it was around the corner of her convent. And then secretly, she ran away from the convent, went to my concert, enjoyed herself, and came back, and then the mother of the convent said, "Where did you go?" And listen, she was already 70 years old. Mm-hmm. I went to the concert of Andre, and I enjoyed myself. And then she had to pray 10 Marys for as a punishment or something. But why I'm going to tell you this, she had an open mind and a happy mind, and she was the whole day listening to my music. She worked her whole life very, very hard to help the poor, but she always listened to my music, and she was very, very positive. So when you ask me what did my music to her, I think it helped her to be 105.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm sorry to hear of her passing, but she must have lived a beautiful life.
Yeah. Of course, it's sad that she's not there anymore, but with 105, she had a happy life.
She had a good run, for sure. Will you please share how you're doing? I know there is a moment back a while that you had to take a time out for your health. And how are you now, and what can you share with your fans?
I can share with my fans that since 8 years now, that's 8 years ago, I worked too hard, and then I turned a button in my head and I said, okay, that's enough. Now I'm going to do sports. So now I do 3 times a week. I have a personal trainer. He comes here in my home because I had a wine cellar. And then I threw away all the wine, and I made of the wine cellar a sports cellar. And now I'm feeling fantastic. 3 times a week, I don't drink alcohol anymore, and I do my sport, and it's not a little bit cardio, but I really do heavy stuff, you know, because muscles, when you are young, the muscles are there and it's okay, but when you're getting older, you have to work to keep your muscles. Don't use it, you lose it. So you have to use your muscles, and that's what I do with heavy weights. And now I feel really fantastic. And every year I'm traveling the world, and I'm younger than all the others in the orchestra.
I read on a website a quote from you. It says, Mozart composed his music not for the elite, but for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I want to do. And that's why I travel the world, to bring this beautiful classical music back to the streets where it belongs, to everybody, not only for the elite.
That was André Rieu in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez. André Rieu and his Johann Strauss Orchestra have a couple of stops in our region soon, in San Diego March 18th at Pechanga Arena, and at the Honda Center in Anaheim March 21st. With that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to André Rieu, as well as to Emmanuel Rogers in his conversation with actor Michael O'Neill. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, quick and easy, at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.